I started very young as a kind of political activist. I came to anarchism in 1979, age 13. I guess the boffins here can do the math as to my age now, but I've been involved in kind of anarchist organizing since then. When I was old enough to leave high school, I moved to the nearest big city, which was Edinburgh. But if you like, by then, I'd already been involved in both specifically anarchist organizing and organizing other kind of campaigns, single issue things like the peace movement, which was a big deal in Britain as well as America in the late 70s, early 80s and such like. So when I moved to Edinburgh in 84, I already had kind of a few years of political activism under my belt, so to speak. To briefly give some of the context of what I'll be talking about, or the what was going on in Britain at the time. Again, in many ways, in the broader kind of political thing, what was going on in Britain in the 80s was, I believe, similar to what was happening in North America. You had Reagan, we had Thatcher, and that decade basically saw, which actually started in the mid-70s, I guess, after 73, but kind of accelerated the rollback of the kind of liberal consensus of the 50s and 60s that everything was getting better and wages were rising. And so in Britain in the 80s, this meant a huge attack on all fronts, on basically on the working class and their standards of living. Britain's much vaunted welfare state, which you're probably familiar with, again, was pretty much dismantled in the 80s. Again, I got free teeth and free glasses, for example. By the time, by 89, you had to pay for glasses and teeth. Well, it embarrasses me to say so. I went to university. Again, in my day, people of low income, of which I was one of them, were basically paid a grant to go to university. So in effect, I was paid. I was unemployed for a couple of years, and then I was paid twice as much money to go to university, which was brilliant. So I went to university for 4 years. Again, by the time I graduated from university in 89, they were no longer giving grants. They, by then, had come to an American system of loans and such like. There was a huge attack on organized labor in Britain, which culminated in 84-85 with the attack on the miners, who historically had always been the most political and combative, if you like, of the trade unions, and also were fucking huge. There was a quarter of a million miners in Britain in 1984, so they were also a numerically huge, powerful union controlling coal, obviously, which was the main source of power in Britain at the time. The miner strike was a huge deal in Britain. Again, myself and many others were actively involved in strike support in the miner strike, and actually this small town where I grew up, Stirling, was the first pit that actually went on strike. It was called Paul Mays, was the name of the pit. The first pit that went on strike and the last pit to go back in 85. So I say there's a kind of a track across the board on, again, the situation in Britain. By the mid-80s, we had officially about 15% unemployment, which meant in reality unemployment in Scotland was actually about 25%. So again, there was not only massive unemployment and poverty, but again, huge attacks on what little welfare was given to those people that were relying on the welfare state. So again, in the 80s, in my time in Britain, the categories for people that were eligible for unemployment, for example, used to be in Britain, in Scotland, you can leave school at 15, which most people do. Again, in the 80s, they made a law that you couldn't claim unemployment until you were 18, for example. So straight away, there was hundreds and more thousands of people that weren't eligible for benefits. They changed the way that you got housing benefit. You used to get housing benefit, which meant if you were unemployed or low-paid, they would pay a portion or all of your rent. Again, they did away with that. So again, I kind of across the board in the 80s, there was these massive attacks on the standard of living, which kind of culminated, which I'll talk about a bit later, with the poll tax, which was the most overt, if you like, attack on, or the most overt method of wealth redistribution upward, shall we say. As I pinted out before, Britain in general, and Scotland in particular, horrible poverty, all the kind of cliched indexes of poverty, we kind of led the way in Western Europe and Scotland. Highest rates of heart disease, alcoholism. Edinburgh, where I lived, say, for 10 years. I'm sure probably many of you have seen Train Spotting, which had a very bizarre view of heroin addiction in Edinburgh. Edinburgh was a heroin capital of Europe. Heroin is a poverty thing. Because of the heroin, Edinburgh was also the AIDS capital of Europe because of the needles. It's very miserable in many ways. Perhaps at this point I should mention the hoary old question of class, which played a great deal of great importance in our organising. I must say it strikes me as a little bizarre here in America that while it strikes me that America is perhaps even more class stratified, shall we say, than even Britain, there's very little class consciousness, or even, shall we say, an awareness of class and what that actually means, and perhaps more particularly as organisers, how we take that on board. I'm going to be a bit of a bastard here and ask you a quick question. Can everyone who's either a student in higher education at university or college or has graduated, can they raise their hands? That, of course, includes me. So virtually everyone in this, except what, two or three people?
You say graduated.
I said,
hold a degree.
No, either are in college or have graduated. So that is one cliched indicator of class. According to the Wall Street Journal, which someone pointed out to me just last month, only 20% of whitey goes to college. Again, a college education is a huge indicator of class and brings with it all kinds of privileges, opportunities, which are not available to most. White folks, are the amount of people of colour in America going to college is even less. And while the anarchist movement here seems to acknowledge the role that, say, race or white supremacy or gender plays within the movement and how, people are willing to acknowledge that and acknowledge that that may bring privileges, may influence culture, and hence may change, skew, alter the way that people that have those privileges interact in their organising, interact with others. There seems to be a complete denial, or I don't know, denial. It's not an issue, class, which I, again, perhaps coming from more class-conscious Britain, find really bizarre, especially given that as organisers, as activists, and as anarchists, presumably we think that change is going to come because most people actually need change, and hence the motor of change will be those that actually need the change, which is the working class. But I digress slightly there. In terms of the kind of activist context of the 80s in Britain, there was a fairly vibrant, I guess, anarchist movement of various strands. There was three national anarchist organisations in Britain in the 80s. I was never a member of any of them. There was probably the most well-known, perhaps over here, was called Class War, which don't really exist anymore. There was Class War. There was another group which at that time was called the Direct Action Movement, and is now called the Solidarity Federation. And there was another group called the Anarchist Communist Federation, who are now, I believe, are just called the Anarchist Federation. So these were three kind of, if you like, formal anarchist organisations. They had membership, whatever. The biggest of which was probably the Direct Action Movement, which had about 150 members. Again, to give you some, I guess, how pitiful in one sense, numerically, these things were. Class War at its height, despite selling maybe 5,000 to 10,000 papers at its height, again, had a formal membership, I think, at its height, which was in about 1991, of 130 members. And the Anarchist Communist Federation, despite their claims otherwise, never had more than about 30 members. yes, no one said it was going to be easy. One of the advantages, if you like, anarchists have had, and still have, I believe, in Britain, over the rest of the kind of self-identified non-parliamentary left, shall we say, is that anarchists had a higher not only class consciousness, but working class membership, shall we say, which is to prove pretty important in terms of organising. Edinburgh class war, for example, I lived with half of Edinburgh class war, which numbered four, and I lived with two of them. So again, in terms of the indexes I threw out there, for example, pointers of class, none of Edinburgh class war were college educated, and all left school at 15, and hence were actually normal people. When I moved to Edinburgh the rest of the left in Britain, again, you're probably familiar with many of their sister organisations exist here in America. Probably the most numerical was the ISO, who have about 4,000 members at any one time in Britain. And again, certainly that was the case in the 80s, virtually all of whom are students other than their cadre leadership, who are all... The ISO in Britain at the time had 80 full-time paid organisers, again, two of which were in Edinburgh. Secondly, there was another Trotskyist group called Militant, who technically were the youth wing of the Labour Party, though they were, to use a kind of leftist jargon, they were entryists. They tried to enter into the Labour Party to take it over, and they were eventually expelled, actually, in the 90s. But they were somewhat different from the rest of the left, in that actually in Glasgow particularly, they actually, again, actually had some working class base and support, so they were a bit different. There's also the other main leftist group in Britain was the RCP, who are, unlike the RCP here, are actually, again, a trot group. Maoists don't really exist in Britain, except for kind of the odd American transplant. And there was various other smaller, you know, Spartacists, again, who seem to be largely American, and various other folks. So that was the kind of the terrain, if you like, that when I moved to Edinburgh, which was in 84. Edinburgh had seen, and Scotland in general, had a history of pretty good kind of anarchist organising. Again, I didn't move to Edinburgh in terms of a vacuum. There was an Edinburgh anarchist group called Little by Little, which I guess summed up the diminutive, goals and aspirations they had. So there'd been a kind of bunch of specifically anarchist organising in Edinburgh prior to my arrival. And one of the benefits was there was a bunch of folks, some of whom were involved in these, again, former anarchist organisations I talked about, and other just kind of odd folk, many of whom were older. So there was kind of some continuity of more older, experienced activists, if you like. So I moved to Edinburgh, say, in 84, with the middle of the miners' strike, which was a huge deal in Britain. It was a year-long strike, insane levels of state repression, of violence, of... A gloriously heroic strike, which was horribly crushed. The miners lost, and now there are 25. I said there was 250,000 miners in Britain in 1984. Now there are 20,000 left, all of whom work at private pits. Coal mining doesn't exist in Britain anymore, for better or for worse. So shortly after I arrived, a group of these pre-existing activists and a bunch of new folks kind of came together, at first in a kind of ad hoc way, and eventually we settled on a name, which was Community Resistance. We were all anarchists or anti-authoritarians, though there was some argument that not everyone wanted to be called anarchists, so we never actually technically called ourselves an anarchist group, hence the title Community Resistance, because we didn't want to alienate people who were frightened or put off by the term anarchist. And pretty quickly we became fairly large and pretty well organised. We used to meet on Monday meetings, and typically at our meetings there'd be between 10 and 30 people. So we were fairly early on a pretty large group. The main focus of the group was twofold. One was doing what we called, I guess, solidarity work, which was largely strike support work, which I'll go into in a minute. And the other kind of half of it was more, shall we say, cliched or typical kind of propaganda work. So in terms of the propaganda thing, we would hold things like public meetings. We would, to our eternal shame, debate the ISO once, which is... I mean, again, it's something I fundamentally disagree with now, in the same way that I wouldn't debate a fascist, but nevertheless, I was outvoted in that one. I debated the Green Party once. We'd send out, you know, we'd send speakers to speak in universities and high schools. We would show films. We'd have discussion meetings. You know, so kind of more typical, if you like, propaganda work. And I'd say the other thing is we had a kind of solidarity work, which was largely based around strike support. What that meant was, if we would hear of a strike, which typically would be a wildcat strike, and hence was not supported by any union, so either the workers involved in that strike were non-unionised, or the union refused to support it because it didn't follow proper procedures in terms of balloting or union membership, we would get involved in terms of solidarity with that strike. The biggest one we were involved in, and the most, hence, spectacularly successful, was a bunch of women workers, of course they were women, who made lampshades in this kind of factory, sweatshop, whatever you want to call it, just outside Glasgow. And, you know, they worked in horrible sweatshop conditions, no ventilation, no breaks, shit wages, blah, 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 weren't allowed to go to the toilet, whatever. So they contacted the general kind of employees union in Britain, is the Trade and General Workers Union. So they contacted the T&G. T&G said, oh, yes, this is really terrible, join us, and, you know, it'll be really great. So they joined the union, promptly went on strike, and then the union, of course, said, oh, sorry, you have to be, for it to be an official strike, you have to union members for 12 weeks, so we can't support you. So for some reason, we knew one of the workers in this factory, or a friend of a friend. So we got involved in this strike, I say, as a kind of strike support group. The factory was basically contracted simply to make lampshades for Laura Ashley. I don't know if you have Laura Ashley in America. I think you do. That kind of stores that sell lampshades, I guess, and all kinds of things like that. So our cunning strategy in terms of winning their strike. So these women all went on strike and hence were promptly sacked for going on an illegal strike. So the strategy was that we would picket and put pressure on Laura Ashley, since they had the entire contract for the factory. So in turn, Laura Ashley would put pressure on the factory owner to reinstate the women, you know, open the windows, whatever, pay them real money, etc., etc. And that campaign actually lasted for about a year. And in the end, we won totally. So we started off doing pickets in Edinburgh through our contacts, largely through the kind of anarchist movement, so through friends, comrades in other cities. The pickets spread throughout Scotland, throughout Britain, eventually throughout Europe, and I believe perhaps even to America. And eventually there was such pressure and embarrassment, and, you know, it got to be start to get into the news, etc., that Laura Ashley did put pressure on the factory, and they won entirely. We were involved in a couple of other strikes, which again, we won. Actually, everything we did, it was community distance, we actually won, which is a part of our glorious strategy of victory. Which is really great. We were involved in some other activities. We did a bunch of anti-apartheid solidarity stuff. Again, as anarchists, we were prescient enough that we were wholly opposed to the ANC, so we didn't do any solidarity stuff with the ANC. But at the time, there was all this, I don't know if anyone remembers, again in the 80s, there was all this, within the ANC were in exile, within South Africa, there was all kinds of shit going on, including there was all these autonomous township committees that were basically taking over the townships, in effect the shanty towns where most folk lived. And so we did a lot of solidarity work with folk who were part of these. I mean, the main thing that we were doing was with this township called Alexandria, I believe, which is the main kind of black township ghetto thing outside of Johannesburg. So we did a bunch of solidarity work with them, again, pickets, educational stuff, sending them money, whatever. So I'd say we had 3 or 4 years of actually very successful, somewhat ad hoc, kind of anarchist organising, which was partly, again, was a kind of learning process for us. Pretty successful. And then in the I believe, I've not got the chronology completely right here, but in 87, the then Conservative government, Gerald Margaret Thatcher et al., mooted their kind of final pièce de résistance, the jewel in their crown of, as I say, this kind of upward wealth redistribution, which was what they called the community charge, which popularly became known as the poll tax. Again, briefly, what the poll tax was a flat rate and hence regressive taxation, which was levelled by the local boroughs or counties, whatever you want to call them, the local authorities, to raise money locally. So it was a local tax. So it was a tax raised by the local council, by, you know, Plainfield City Hall or whatever, to raise money for ostensibly local services, to pay for your street lighting, your garbage removal, your local police, your library, whatever. As I'm sure is the case in America, obviously federal funds greatly subsidise what local do. It's the same deal in Britain. And so this was a national tax imposed from above, but it was implemented, if you like, by each local authority, and each local authority would set their level of taxation. And previously, local authorities had raised money by a property tax, which is a much more, not egalitarian, but more egalitarian in that people heretofore paid tax on the value of their property. So if you were not a property owner, which more than 50% of Britain are not, you didn't pay the tax at all. And the dude that lived in Edinburgh Castle paid a lot more tax than some guy living in his one-bedroom apartment, which he owned. So I say this. So this previous property tax, which was called the council tax, was replaced by the poll tax. So the poll tax was a flat rate, regressive tax. Everyone paid the same, whether they lived in Edinburgh Castle. And it was every adult, so every person 18 or over, had to pay this tax. So if you had, you know, four students or perhaps a family of working class people who all lived, you know, with two kids over 18 or still lived at home in their rented or in the projects, whatever, they all had to pay the tax. Each adult over 18 had to pay the tax. So it suddenly meant that, you know, millions of people who hadn't had to pay this tax before had to pay it. You know, in hindsight, obviously, since we won that one as well, which we'll come to later, that was a big miscalculation on the part of the Conservative government. I say it was a stroke of genius in terms of their wealth redistribution plans. In terms of their tactical error, it meant this was the first time that they had done something which affected everybody. Previously, if you're attacking students or people on unemployment or, you know, minors or ambulance workers or teachers, you're kind of picking off people one by one. It's more difficult to get support to sustain a victory. This was an attack on everyone, and certainly given that most people either had never paid this tax or had to pay more tax than before, this was a huge, as it turns out on their part, a gross miscalculation. So Community Resistance, our, you know, mighty anarchist organisation in Edinburgh, when this tax was first mooted, in our infinite wisdom, we decided that we were going to, God damn it, we were going to fight this. We were going to start organising against it. So in 87, they passed a law. What's typical in Britain is that laws are passed a year earlier in Scotland than they are in the rest of Britain. So what they do is typically, you know, go to the poorest, most downtrodden, oppressed bastards and try out a law on them first. And then they modify it for England and Wales, you know, to see how it works, etc. So like with many other legislation, and actually the case of Northern Ireland is completely different. Northern Ireland is basically a police state where they try out all kinds of other bizarre shit. But Northern Ireland is governed very differently from the rest of Britain. So Northern Ireland didn't get the poll tax, for example, because they already had death squads. They didn't really need the poll tax. But so the tax was mooted to come into Scotland a year earlier. So basically we started organising against the tax a year before its implementation. And the implementation was, for the first year, what they did was compile the poll tax register. Because, I say, most people had never had to pay this tax before, they had to compile a list of everyone eligible to pay the tax so they could hence tax them. What this meant was, the main way they got the tax, where they compiled it, was through the electoral register. In Britain, the law is you don't have to vote, but it's a criminal offence not to register to vote, if that makes sense. Again, that's a very archaic, bizarre law, and before the poll tax campaign, no one had ever been prosecuted for not registering to vote. But suddenly what you found, because they're mainly using the electoral register as the way of gathering the poll tax register, you found people being charged for not registering to vote, being fined or whatever. So it was a criminal offence not to register for the electoral register, and it was also a criminal offence not to register for the poll tax register. So you'd have people coming knocking on your doors saying, you know, how many people live here, what are your ages, I want to verify that you are Ramsay Kinnan and you live here. And so our first campaign against the poll tax was campaigning against the registration. And again, our campaigning, which it was throughout the whole poll tax campaign, was cliched community organising. And again, what we decided, the Community Resistance, the Edinburgh Anarchist Group, was that it would be community organising. So what we did, which I'll come to a bit later, which I think was a grievous error, was in effect we dissolved Community Resistance. We stopped meeting on a Monday. And we thought the poll tax is such a big deal that we're going to stop all our other activities and concentrate on fighting the poll tax. So what it meant is, in effect, we dissolved this anarchist group to, this sounds kind of patronising and bizarre, but to go into the communities where we already lived and start anti-poll tax organising. So what that meant was, we divided up Edinburgh geographically as to where we lived and formed local anti-poll tax groups. So there was me and another guy, we're south side against the poll tax. And so depending where people lived in Edinburgh, since we lived all over Edinburgh, we formed these local anti-poll tax groups. And so we engaged in what I'm sure many of you are familiar are kind of cliched community organising. So the first thing we did to form our anti-poll tax group is we made leaflets and flyers, which we posted in our area, south side of Edinburgh. In the case of, you know, the group I was involved in, informing people what the poll tax meant, you know, what it would entail. And we're your neighbours, and we're holding a public meeting in the local church hall. And it was a church hall, which we'd somehow forgotten to burn down earlier in our activities. And so, you know, we fly-posted and said, you know, we're having a meeting in the church hall, whatever it was called, Saint something, I'm sure. And, you know, to form a local anti-poll tax group. At that first meeting, because remember, we were organising a year before they even started registering people for the poll tax, other than me and my... other anarchist comrade, two people turned up. So two of the community turned up, other than us two, but that was a start. It was the start of Southside Against Poll Tax. And then so again, we knocked on doors, we produced leaflets every couple of months saying what was happening, how you could, you know, what you could do against it. Which was somewhat tricky, as I say, because it was a criminal offence not to register. So we gave it information on ways to delay registration, how not to do it. But we didn't want to tell people at this point to break the law and get fucked, basically, over not registering, because in our, again, our great knowledge, we knew that the real battle would come over payment or not of the actual tax. So we were organising for a year, say, without any largely spectacular effects. Then, after the first year of registration, so this, hence, for 2 years of organising down the road, so we're now into maybe 88, 89, people actually have to start paying the poll tax. And then the campaign really kind of went ballistic. It really mushroomed, and a lot of people started to get involved. Our strategy from day one had always been to defeat the poll tax. It was going to be community organised and would be based on making the tax unworkable, i.e. non-payment of the tax. So again, our strategies were largely the same in terms of putting out information, and again, perhaps a strategic error. Again, without going to kind of too much into arcane British law, I say not to register for the poll tax register was a criminal offence, which means you could be fined, and hence, if you didn't pay your fine, go to prison, which is pretty serious, especially for working class people. Because of whatever laws and the way the tax was, to not pay the poll tax was a civil offence, which meant, again, was tactically very useful for us. So what that meant was, if you didn't pay the poll tax, you couldn't be fined, and you couldn't go to prison. The way that they recovered for people that did not pay the tax, they had two ways of recovering the money for people who refused to pay or couldn't pay. One was getting employers to garnish your wages, and or getting the welfare state to, you know, garnish your unemployment money. So, there are laws in Britain. You know, you're only allowed to take X amount, 10% or whatever. And the other way, which was more common, because often, again, employers are not willing to garnish their employees. It's not a good employee relations tactic to withhold your employees' wages. By far the main tactic of them trying to recover unpaid taxes, and i.e. force people to pay, was sending the sheriff's officers, and I think they're also called sheriffs in America. You know, if you don't pay your rent, who comes to evict you? It's the sheriff. If you don't pay your phone bill, who comes to disconnect your phone or your electricity? It's the sheriffs. Am I correct? In America as well, they come and
for eviction. No. That's true.
Only for eviction. Only for eviction. The utilities would send the technician or do it from the pole outside of your house or something.
Right. Okay. But so same, but certainly in terms of the eviction for non-payment of rent, it's the same deal. There are people called sheriffs. They're called bailiffs in Scotland. Sheriffs in England are the same thing. And they come and... So what they did in Britain was the sheriffs, bailiffs would come round and do what's called a warrant sale, which means they are allowed to sell your goods, your TV, your stereo, your hi-fi, your Bob Dylan bootleg collection, whatever, to recover the amount of unpaid tax. Again, by law, which is very convenient for us, they have to tell you when they're coming round to do this warrant sale. So our basis of resistance to the poll tax was saying, we're your local anti-poll tax group, here's your hotline number, here's the information. When the sheriffs come round, give us a call, we will protect you, we will ensure that the sheriffs do not enter your home and take your shit. And so that was the basis of the campaign, and in that we were 100% successful. Non-payment in Britain as a whole, at its height, literally half the adult population didn't pay the poll tax. So out of 34 million adults, people over 18 in Britain, 17 million people didn't pay. The government, of course, not being completely stupid, estimated that there'd be about 10% non-payment. So they'd built that into their, you know, how the tax would work, etc. They estimated about 10% non-payment. We had 50% non-payment. And there was not one single successful warrant sale ever in Britain. And they tried hundreds and hundreds of thousands of times. There was millions of non-payers, so these people were visited, you know. So any day in Edinburgh, there might be 5 attempted warrant sales. And we were organised enough that typically what would happen would be, you know, someone would call up their various anti-poll tax groups hotline number and say, hey, you know, the sheriffs are coming around a week on Tuesday. So on a week on Tuesday, there'd be 100 people standing outside the house, you know, in the house, banners hanging outside the house saying, you know, we're not paying, fuck you, whatever. Typically, the sheriffs would turn up and just walk away again. Occasionally, they'd get beaten up. Occasionally, their cars would get smashed. So, I mean, there was some physical force involved, if you like, but it was the threat of... And the police never once intervened. Again, partly it's a civil matter, but partly, you know, these are agents of the state being thwarted every day. The police never once intervened. Our presumption was, again, the police can't cope with all over Britain wide-scale civil disorder. They can't have 5 riots in Edinburgh and 5 riots in Glasgow and 5 riots in every other city every day to cope with. You know, we were prepared to fight, shall we say. So we were, you know, entirely successful. I mean, there was a bunch of other stuff which I'll talk about. I really, as I'm kind of rambling on here, I like to talk about briefly in terms of the poll tax. So say the general strategy was non-payment. It was gloriously successful. In terms of, so what we did, so this Edinburgh anarchist group, we dissolved to work on the poll tax. I say we were, good for us, we were the first people in Britain to do so. Again, because we had a pretty sophisticated level of organisation by then, we were also conscious in spreading this poll tax stuff. So we produced early on how to make your own anti-poll tax group kit. And so we would send that to anyone who wanted it, again, through kind of anarchist contacts all over Britain. We would send speakers out, you know, so here's how you form an anti-poll tax group. You call a public meeting. We suggest you get someone from the local community to speak. We can also send a more experienced, and again, remember, because it started in Scotland a year earlier, we'd already been doing it before England. So when we were sending out our emissaries, shall we say, of revolt, we already actually had people who were experienced. The anti-poll tax campaign in general, I'd say, was fucking massive. 17 million people didn't pay. There was hundreds of thousands of actual activists, people producing the leaflets, knocking on doors. Again, all the kind of cliched community organising. Every Saturday, we did an information table outside our local supermarket, you know, with leaflets on the poll tax, and here's your hotline number. I say kind of cliched community organising, knocking on doors. Every 3 months, we produced a new leaflet. Here's the update. We did posters, you know, trying to be witty. Every time a new Hollywood movie came out, we'd tie it into a new poster campaign. So I remember at the time, Kevin Costner's embarrassing attempt at Robin Hood came out, if you remember that one. So here's a classic Hollywood film about Robin Hood stealing from the rich, giving to the poor. So of course we had all these pictures of Kevin Costner in his tights, saying, you know, Kevin's not paying, you know, that kind of thing. You know, we had posters. The only person other than people under 18 and members of mental institutions, and prisoners, of course, because prisoners are not human, the only person in Britain who wasn't eligible to pay the poll tax was the Queen and the royal family. So we had all these pictures of the Queen, you know, with a speech bubble going, one isn't paying, coming out of her mouth. And, you know, so we were pretty clever and inventive. In terms of the structure of the anti-poll tax movement, I say it was originated by anarchists, and it was started by anarchists, and in many ways we very definitely led it, informed it. We were undoubtedly, and I'll get to this in a second, the vanguard of the movement. And in many ways, hence the organisation that the anti-poll tax movement followed was a reflection of our anarchist organising techniques. So there was federations, you know, we organised locally. The 10 local groups which started in Edinburgh, which were started by us, there was an Edinburgh Federation. There was then Scottish federations of the different federations from different cities. Then there was then an All-Britain Federation. Very early on, of course, as soon as the rest of the left realised that the anti-poll tax movement actually might be a big thing, and hence they might be able to recruit and paper sell because of it, you know, like swarms of leeches, they descended upon it. That was a huge problem for us. I mean, there were some hilarious early incidents. For example, the ISO, I say one of the most numerical, early on literally told their members to pay the poll tax because the anti-poll tax movement was not led by the mighty battalions of labour and hence was community organised. Hence, the anti-poll tax struggle was a bourgeois deviation from the class struggle. And hence they told their members to pay the poll tax, which is, of course, fucking brilliant. Because 6 months later, they were, of course, trying to tail end the struggle, and we were just, you know, laughing at them and whatever. But nevertheless, as probably some of you are aware who have been involved in organising, the left are pretty good at leeching on the struggles. And probably, after the first year, probably 50% of our organisational activities were actually in fighting the left to preserve the integrity of the anti-poll tax movement. Which meant a number of things. So, for example, as I say, Edinburgh started with 10 anti-poll tax groups, which were started by us anarchists, but of course the majority of members of these groups were not anarchists. Once the movement took off, thousands of more anarchists didn't appear, but thousands of regular, normal humans appeared and actually wanted to fight the poll tax and got involved, say, largely normal. I mean, in one sense, I say, in many ways, it was every leftist's wet dream. He was normal. Ordinary people were getting involved in politics and were actually leafing and, you know, whatever. You know, housewives and workers and, wow, it was great. But, of course, the left moved in very quickly and did kind of typical tactics. So it ended up in Edinburgh, there's 21 anti-poll tax groups. Of the 11 new anti-poll tax groups, those 11 groups are all dominated by various different left factions. And so, of course, because they were a majority of groups, and many of these groups were literally phony groups. So one of the left groups would take one of the areas that we were working in and say, take a smaller area of that. And so, you know, I was in Southside, so they might say we're West Southside against the poll tax to split up. You know, all that kind of leftist bullshit. Equally, because the left in Britain tends to tail end the Labour Party, although it was a nationally kind of mandated tax, because it was a local tax raising money for local issues, it meant that Labour councils were actually the ones sending in the sheriffs and actually implementing the tax. So most of the left, the strategy of the left was the tax is really bad, but either you pay it or you don't, but basically you have to, you know, vote Labour in 4 years' time and they'll repeal the tax. So a lot of the left, we had to fight them because it was actually, we were campaigning against local Labour councils who were actually implementing the tax. So, for example, every time the Edinburgh Labour Council debated the tax, we would fight our way past the police, invade the council chambers and disrupt their meetings so they could never once ever successfully talk about the poll tax within the actual council meetings. But it meant, latterly, not only did we have to literally fight our way past the pigs, we'd have to fight our way past militant tenancy, who, remember, as I said before, are technically the youth wing of the Labour Party, because although they're against the poll tax, they don't want us disrupting their Labour Council meeting. So there was all this kind of, I'm saying, not often, occasionally, it would actually come to blows, and it was a bad scene. As some of you may be aware, the poll tax, you know, was fought on a variety of levels, and again, I want to talk about this a bit in a second. there were several kind of spectacular demonstrations, and ended up in the biggest Protex demonstration, perhaps the biggest demonstration again in certainly recent British history. 500,000 people marched, ended up in Trafalgar Square in 1990, and there was a huge riot because basically the police attacked the demonstration, drove their vehicles straight into the demonstration, charged horses, and they didn't expect people to fight back again because they were a bit foolish in that instance, and people fought back, rioted, basically took over central London, the rich part of London, which was fucking great. The police lost control, withdrew. The South African embassy was set on fire, for example, in Trafalgar Square. You know, McDonald's were trashed. There's brilliant photographs after the day of, you know, all these cars burnt out. So there'll be a burnt out Porsche, a burnt out Mercedes, some guy's little Fiat untouched, another Porsche. You know, it was brilliant. Again, as a witty aside, class war, to their credit, got a huge impetus because of the poll tax riot. You know, the riot was going on. It's one of these, you know, spectacular riots that you can watch it on TV as it's happening. Again, we as in the Scottish folk, we'd had a peaceful march the same day in Glasgow, peaceful because the police were too afraid to attack the march, unlike London. So we were all, like, kind of watching it on the telly, yes, as, you know, London was rioting. And so they... This was 1990. It was the poll tax riot. So the spokesperson, so, you know, as the riot is going on, the BBC and ITV pulling all these, you know, talking heads to talk about the riot. So they got a member of Class War, and, you know, they're viciously attacking this guy, poor innocent from Class War, and who was brilliant under fire. I mean, I'm all for having good, intelligent, intelligible spokespeople that deal with the media. I think it's a horrible thing that anarchism has a bunch of retards who speak to the media. If you know, speaking to the media is a skill, and if people don't have that, they shouldn't, like me, they shouldn't be in front of a microphone. But anyway, so the guy from Class War, you know, he's being horribly attacked again, you know, you're a bunch of mindless thugs and hooligans. He said, look, Class War has 100 members. Of course, you know, there are members of Class War out there rioting at the moment. We didn't start the riot. That's ridiculous. That's preposterous. But, you know, we fully support it. As far as we're concerned, the people rioting are working class heroes, and we fully support the riot, which was great. Whereas the head of Militant, who was also had managed to wheedle himself to be head of the All Britain Anti-Poll Tax Federation, a guy called Tommy Sheridan, who's now head of the Scottish Socialist Party. Tommy Sheridan did a classic Medea Benjamin, shall we say, in Seattle, and said, you know, we will work with the police. These people are, you know, nothing but criminals and scumbags, and we will work with the police to name names. So, of course, Militant took a hell of a beating over that one, deservedly so, since, you know, the head of Militant, and technically, officially, the head of the All Britain Anti-Poll Tax Federation. So Militant, several branches of Militant defected en masse to various anarchist organisations, and they, you know, that was really great. But I guess that, although I say people may have heard of the anti-poll tax riot, and that was great, the poll tax was defeated by this kind of cliched pedestrian grassroots organising. I think demonstrations have a place. They're inspiring for people that are there. They're inspiring for us watching on the telly. But the riots, and there was various other poll tax riots and public disturbances, that didn't defeat the poll tax. What defeated the poll tax was a mass campaign of non-payment, which could only succeed because it was backed up by this kind of pedestrian, boring grassroots organising, which meant that we could actually back up people, protect them, and make sure that their shit wasn't taken by the sheriffs. So that was the poll tax. So that was the kind of the last thing that this Edinburgh Anarchist Group was involved in, and like all our other stuff, we won completely. And the poll tax was eventually repealed, and Margaret Thatcher's reputation took such a beating that she resigned. And so it could be argued that Edinburgh anarchists brought down Margaret Thatcher. I'd say she resigned and was replaced by this dude called John Major. So the Conservative Party were not taken out of power, but there was a kind of internal power struggle within the Conservative Party, and she was, in effect, forced to resign. After that, so the poll tax, I think, was repealed in the end of 91. We were involved in other stuff in Edinburgh thereafter, and at the time, the other big thing we were involved in was the Gulf War stuff. And again, perhaps just as an illustration of example of what a little band of dedicated revolutionaries can do, there was a lot of anti-war organising in Edinburgh and Britain at the time. which was very good and pretty successful, and very much of a contrast. Again, I don't know how much you Americans remember, but in 1982, Britain fought a valiant campaign in the Falklands to keep the Falkland sheep British. And that was a really horrifying thing for us people who didn't like sheep, shall we say, which is rare in Scotland, has to be said. But in that, at the time in 82, there was insane nationalism and xenophobia. It was fucking frightening. It was also the same year that Prince Charles married poor old Lady Di. And there was this huge wave of patriotism, nationalism. I mean, it was every window, every house had a fucking Union Jack in the window. And for us people that were campaigning against the Gulf War, the Falklands War, it was a horrible, you know, we were this tiny minority of nutters that no one supported. Whereas in contrast to the Gulf War, people in Britain largely by then seemed to be largely indifferent. But as I say, as an example of what a small dedicated band of revolutionaries can do, the organising in Edinburgh, again, the organising meetings against the Gulf War were like about 200 people, most of whom, again, were not anarchists. We managed to get this Edinburgh anti-Gulf War group to adopt its slogans and its organising strategies, no war but the class war, and no blood for oil, which is, again, pretty impressive given that we're dealing with, you know, church groups, you know, liberals, pacifists. So to get this sort of huge anti-war coalition in Edinburgh to adopt as their official slogans, no war but the class war and no blood for oil, was, I'll say, no mean feat of anarchist intervention organising. So that was the glorious successes, shall we say. So I know I've kind of rambled way over. I just want to talk about a couple of things of why actually I think it was an utter failure and disaster, despite the fact that we won every strike and defeated the poll tax and sort of didn't defeat the Gulf War but had a good time as well. And that's also what I'm going to talk very briefly about, the role of organising, of organisers, and specifically of anarchist organisations. I say, given that on the face of it, ostensibly, we were hugely successful. Everything we touched turned to gold and utter victory. I think insofar as that we were successful, and again, let's bear in mind that our successes were largely on single-issue campaigns, whether it's the poll tax, whether it's, again, we were very successful in organising unemployed and doing low-wage struggles and stuff, which I forgot to mention. But that these were single-issue things, which we largely won. I think our successes, however, in all these different forms of organisation, came because that we were organised. We were this, not tightly knit, but we were an anarchist group that were organised as anarchists and whatever, left communists and people that didn't want to call themselves anarchists, shall we say. But nevertheless, for this give argument, I'll say we were organised as anarchists. And hence that we were, for the struggles that we got involved in, we brought to those struggles both our own experiences of being organisers, and again, there was different levels of experiences involved, but also that we could offer the solidarity, for example, with strike support, from a position of strength, and from a principal position of strength, that we were coming to a strike or a campaign over to, you know, whatever it was, that A, we had something to offer people in terms of skills, of knowledge we could teach them. Again, presumably as anarchists, we actually want to empower people. We don't want to be the leaders. We want to give people that are, other people that are engaged in struggle with us, or that we're lending hand to that struggle. Presumably the role as organisers is to empower those people, to say, look, you can do it yourselves, and here's the tools for you to be able to do that. Here's the skills you might need. Again, the logic that we use with, you know, sending out, here's how to do your own anti-poll tax campaign kit that we produced. So our successes were that we were actually organised. We knew what we were doing, and we had our own internal set of politics as to why we were doing it. And I think that's why we were successful. We could offer tangible, you know, we were offering solidarity, I'd say, from a position of strength. I think in the poll tax campaign, I'd say, which in many ways is our crowning victory, and as I'll say briefly, our utter defeat, was, if you cast your mind back to my previous rambling, we agreed formally to dissolve the anarchist group Community Resistance to concentrate on the poll tax. That, in retrospect, I think, gave us all kinds of problems. It firstly gave us problems within the campaign, the anti-poll tax campaign, because we'd lost our strength in numbers and our, if you like, our ideological unity and our organisation. It meant it much more difficult both to organise people on the ground and also to fight the left. So although we organised as anarchists, we didn't bring or we didn't make explicit the reasons why. So in our local anti-Poltax group, for example, you know, because we organised it and because we were the instigators and the primary organisers and in many ways the leading militants, if you want to call it that, for us it was natural to organise and decentralise, then to have a federation. You know, in our Poltax groups we didn't have a treasury or a secretary, for example, and that was okay by us. But we didn't impart the... Although the non-anarchists, which again were the vast majority after the first year of people involved in that campaign, might be able to witness the efficacy and the success of that organising, they weren't aware of the theory and practice and history behind that. So although they could see it worked, when the left would come in, and so, you know, so the left would say, well, hey, you've got this federation and we've now got all these fake and phony groups, so why don't we have a steering committee for the Edinburgh Federation? And why don't we have a treasury and a secretary? And we're going, oh, no, that's a really bad idea. But to Joe Public Normal, well, why not? Why not have a secretary and a treasurer? And why not have a steering committee? So because we hadn't done that political education of why actually that might lead to bureaucracy and it's bad and then the commie scum take over, it's very difficult in that meeting where you know there's the fucking commie scum, we know who they are, you know, we may have had to headbutt them the previous night or whatever, we know who they are, we see them packing a meeting, we know what they're going to do, but then they innocently suggest that perhaps we should have a steering committee and a treasurer and a secretary, and we know they're all going to vote themselves onto those positions and hence take over the federation. It's difficult for us to articulate that without sounding stupid, or why not have a secretary? Why not have a steering committee? That makes sense. We're a huge federation. We have hundreds of activists in this federation. Why not? You see, I mean, so it made it a lot more difficult for us both to fight the left on that terrain and hence to retain the integrity of the anti-Poltax movement. And then the second thing on the larger, and why I say we lost the anti-Poltax struggle, we defeated the Poltax, Thatcher resigned. Basically, the Poltax was replaced by another tax, which is virtually exactly the same with a different name. Now, we'd been fighting the Poltax for 4 years. We were burnt out. We were fucked. I mean, you know, we were exhausted. We were... And I would argue because of our lack of... Because we just treated it as a highly successful single-issue campaign and because we'd succeeded in bringing in all these previously apolitical people who'd become, through the years of struggle, become political militants, activists, organisers, because of that devoid of theory behind that. I mean, so what we as anarchists wanted, for example, is our logic was... If you have this whole community defence organisation that can stop the sheriffs, the bailiffs, why can't we stop them for evicting someone for non-payment of rent? Why can't we use this defence mechanism for other attacks on poverty? Why can't we stop them turning off someone's electricity? Again, in Scotland, not having heat is a really fucking... And maybe it is in Vermont in the winter as well. It's a fucking big issue. Tens of thousands of people die of hypothermia every year because they can't afford to heat their homes. You know, so that, again, is a big, or ought to be, and is a big community issue. In Britain, heat, which is fucking expensive, electricity or gas. So our logic was, we have this organisation in place, why can't we use that not just to defend people for non-payment of poll tax, but for other attacks on poor people, for, you know, non-payment of your utility bill or non-payment of your rent. Or, and we couldn't do that. And again, it didn't happen. Although there were some attempts by some of the different groups to kind of transfer or whatever, you know, turn their anti-Poltax group into a more general solidarity group. They again largely failed. I think there are a couple of them still exist in Britain. But so we failed. So after, you know, 10 years of this spectacularly successful anarchist organising, at the end of it we were left with literally nothing. And we were left with another tax which replaced the poll tax. So we had nothing to show for it. There was no... Worse than that, I would argue, we were left with this spectacular successful anarchist organisation which didn't even exist anymore. So we were left with literally nothing. And so my, I guess, perhaps, and I know I'm meant to facilitate a discussion, which is going to be a bit bizarre, given my facilitation skills, but I guess I just want to leave you with a couple of questions which you can, I don't know, do what you want with. Again, that would be, firstly, what does that mean for, so the, I guess, the scenario, well, the reality that I just had to suffer through, what does that mean for how we organise and what is the role of anarchist groups as opposed to groups which do anarchist organising, for example? Again, I would argue that our success was because we organised as anarchists and took that to the struggles that we offered solidarity to or we led. Secondly, I would want people to, or you know, I suggest you should consider what is the role of a vanguard. What is the meaning of a vanguard in reality? I would argue that Edinburgh Anarchist Group, and again, vanguard is a loaded term, and that's partly why I'm using it deliberately. We were a vanguard. We led the struggle. We didn't dominate it. In fact, you know, we had to fight half the time to stop it being dominated by the commies. But nevertheless, we led it. We invented it. We created the anti-Potax movement. And insofar as we could, we shaped its direction, the methods it took, the tactics it used, the fact that it was community organised as opposed to voting for Labour or whatever. We were definitely a vanguard. And I would argue anarchists will always be a minority, always have been a minority, and where they've been successful in their organising has been acknowledging and being conscious that you are a minority, and that's okay, and it's okay to be a vanguard. Presumably we think our ideas are right, then they are wrong. The difference between us and them is we're right and they're wrong. The other people have vanguards, and they're wrong. That's okay, fuck them. But we should acknowledge that we're right, or not believe in what we believe in, I guess. But the thing is that we, you know, again, to use a cliched historical example, the FAI were formed in 1924, I believe, to make sure that the CNT, this huge anarchist trade union, stayed anarchist. Most of the millions of members of the CNT were not anarchists. In fact, much of the leadership was not anarchist, and the leadership continually tried to make the CNT a more typical reformist union, which would work with the government and blah, blah, blah. The FAI were a conscious vanguard of anarchist militants who were formed explicitly to make sure the CNT remained anarchist. I think that's okay. I think that's, we have to be conscious of who we are and what we're doing and why we're doing it. Similarly, we have to be conscious of what is the role of a group. What is the point of having a group? I think, and again, I would argue my experience in Edinburgh showed there needs to be an infrastructure, there needs to be organisation, there needs to be this stuff in place. You know, we didn't create the poll, we created the anti-poll tax movement. We did not create the poll tax. You know, the Conservative government dreamed up the poll tax. But because there was an infrastructure, because there was organisation, because there was, you know, starting in Edinburgh, but because there was all these other anarchists that we could plug into, there was this, albeit loose-knit, because there was other anarchist organisers there, we could create an anti-poll tax movement. There was some sort of infrastructure there to build an anti-poll tax movement. I think that we have to be organising now as anarchists, so when the next crisis, the next whatever it is that comes along, we have something to build from. So, you know, I think there's a need for infrastructure and organisation, which may, you know, in many ways not do anything spectacular for many years, but is there, is being built quietly, slowly, so when something happens, a revolutionary situation may occur, whatever. I also think infrastructure is crucially important in that how do people come to anarchism? How do they plug in? Part of the success of the left, not the success, why does the left attract recruits? Because they have an infrastructure. You know, perhaps many of you have been members of some of these leftist corpuscules. If you're interested in politics, how would you come to anarchism? How would you ever hear about it? You know, for all their faults, and believe me, I hate them all and want to kill them, the left are somewhat visible. Now, I don't think they do any good, but nevertheless, if you're a student or whatever, you want to get involved in politics, you don't like sanctions on Iraq, whatever it may be, how do you get involved? How do you plug into something? There needs to be anarchist institutions, infrastructure, so people can A, discover anarchism, or B, plug in some way and get involved. And I think I've talked for long enough. Thank you for bearing with me.